Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
It's on! Now we're on! Is it raining? I was just saying, I'm just looking out the window, I got distracted by... Is it raining? I was like writing a thing about like when you're at home. I wasn't writing a thing, I just heard an observation. When you're at home and you hear maybe like some rain at the window, you turn around like you're a detective in a TV show hearing a gun cock. And then I wrote, so the way I wrote it was, you know when you hear rain at the window and you turn around, like, you know when you hear rain at the window and you turn around like you're a detective in a TV show hearing a gun cock? Gun cock. I've got a gun cock. I'm not really mainstream. Anyway, welcome to Fan Club. My name's Nick Helm, and you're listening to my Fan Club. And today I'm joined with... today I'm joined by
today,
my special guest.
Guest.
And friend, Nathaniel.
I can't Metcalf. Believe
Let, I know what it is. It's the rain. The rain's put me off.
You've been put off by the rain.
And my gun cock. Hi, my name's Nick, and this is...
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to Nick and...
Nathaniel Metcalf's
Fan Club. First rule of Fan Club is...
Tell your friends.
Tell your friends about Fan Club. Second rule of Fan Club is...
Please, for the love of God, for the love of Mike...
For the love of Peter, Paul, Mary and Ian.
Friends.
Tell your friends. Just tell friends. Tell them all. Tell them all. Tell them all. News just in. Seth Rogen has got the rights to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Has he? I can imagine him doing something quite interesting with that. Like,
I think, yeah. I mean, I literally interrupted your thought process to say, I think, and then I didn't follow it up with anything. All I achieved was stopping you from talking, so talk.
I think I can imagine him doing something quite interesting with that. I imagine he's probably the right kind of age. He's a couple of years younger than me, which would put him in prime turtle power position to do something good with it. I suspect it probably comes from a good place and he's not doing it to get a bit of moolah, and he's probably got... good plans. He could do quite a funny film, and I think it's quite a funny franchise, you know. It's got like, there's no reason why that wouldn't work as some sort of action comedy.
I think it is potentially a funny franchise. I think it's really interesting. I think Michael Bay has done it, and he's obviously the action guy, so let's make these action movies. Let's make these huge action movies. And there is sort of comedy in it, but the comedy is sort of like maybe an aside. Mm. And I think with the cartoon series, there was comedy in the cartoon series, but it was sort of like lame kids cartoon comedy. Mm. And there was sort of like, they're like, I love the Teenage Mutant Ninja, although to me, I guess they'll always be Hero Turtles. Yeah. I do love them. If you were a turtle, which turtle would you have been?
My favourite when I was a kid was always Raphael.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think he's like, I think he's meant to be the one who's like, isn't he like the sort of silent killer? He's the sort of mysterious one, I think.
He's the moody one. He's the petulant child. He goes off and he sulks a lot and he's sort of, angsty. I was Michelangelo.
He was the Joker. He was the Joker in the pack, was Michelangelo.
He was the party dude.
The party dude. I'd say they all like pizza, but he liked it more than the others.
Well, that's true. Raphael is cool but crude. Give me a break. And Michelangelo is a party dude.
Yeah.
Which is fine when you're a teenager, but it gets slightly sadder as you approach middle age, it turns out.
Also, Raphael was never particularly crude in the cartoon series.
No.
Didn't I go, oh, that's a bit much.
No. No, he didn't like come in and like wipe his ass on the curtains and then go, "What are you going to fucking do about it, Dick?" Once, and then like Leonardo was like, "Oh, he's a bit crude." You know, there was nothing that pushed the boundaries like that. So I think that probably Seth Rogen is going to really push that. I think it's interesting that you've got someone that's famous for comedy that's in charge of a franchise that hasn't really been ever particularly mined for comedy.
Mm.
And really the thing is, it's about these four teenage... It's ridiculous. They're teenagers and they're mutant turtles and they're ninjas. And there should be an action element to that. Mm-hmm. But really, it's a ridiculous thing. And I think that maybe you could really focus on the fact that they're, you know, they're four teenage brothers that are hanging out eating pizza. And then occasionally they have to go out and save the day by doing ninja stuff. I think that I don't understand why they've never made that film, really. Because it's in the title of the film. And I don't feel like I've ever seen it. Mm-hmm. It's in the title of the franchise, and I don't really feel like I've ever seen that film. But
I came to see you, didn't I? I went on my bike the other day to come and see you, and I think we were talking about Seth Rogen in the park, weren't we? I think he came up. And we talked about Seth Rogen and Danny McBride. Danny McBride also, and David Gordon Green, is it? David Gordon Green. They both did Halloween, and they're currently redoing Halloween, and they seemed like quite odd people to take on that franchise. And this feels like almost less of a jump for them to have Seth Rogen do something like Turtles.
I don't think it's that much of a jump. He basically, you know, he basically is a turtle. He is a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. It's not much of a jump at all. I think he's... he's a good choice. I think if he's in it, I don't know. But like, I don't know. I just think, why not? I mean, I didn't actually mind the Michael Bay Turtle films. He didn't direct them though, did he? I didn't mind them.
No, it felt to me, I never saw them. They always struck me as it's something where Michael Bay has had such a huge hit with Transformers, like worldwide, that he's probably got his production company to go, right, we need more of this stuff. So we've done Michael Bay's Transformers, get me another big 80s toy franchise. And they've handed him Turtles.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. I'd rather... Well, but the other thing that we were talking about, I'm not particularly excited about that because I think the Turtles have been sort of like done so many times that you just sort of... It doesn't really feel like a coherent franchise where you can just follow it from beginning to end. It's like they're rebooting it. They've rebooted it more than Spider-Man, you know? Mm. And Spider-Man seems to just about hang together in terms of, well, that's that, and that's that. But I don't know what... I think also Turtles was very much like a... it had its time and its place for me, where I used to be absolutely obsessed with it in the 80s and 90s. But by the time the second film came out, it was over for me. I wasn't even really into... I don't think I even saw the second film in the cinema. Mm. And then years later, I've kind of like acknowledged the fact that I really... Well, I'll tell you this. When we were making Loaded... I've just knocked a bunch of stuff over. But when we were making Loaded, there was me, Johnny Sweet, Sam and Jim... And we all were like trying to work out what our characters were and how we interacted with each other, and sort of like Sam's character kind of like Loaded was about like four sort of like tech guys that end up becoming overnight millionaires because they sell an app to a big corporation and they make loads of money off of it. And a bit happens like overnight. And Sam played sort of like the moody one who would sort of like go off and try and prove himself. And then Jim was sort of in charge and Johnny was sort of nerdy. And I was like this ex-stoner. and we were really trying to sort of like work out what our characters were. And then one day I was just like, we're the fucking Turtles. And you go, we've like, they had the four characters, and it's just like, I'm Michelangelo, Johnny's Donatello, Sam was Raphael, and Jim was Leonardo. Mary McCormack was Shredder, and Lolly was sort of like April O'Neil. And you go, oh my God, it's fucking, it's the, we've made the Turtles. And I thought that that was really funny. I'm sure the writers wouldn't have been that impressed, but like...
No, but it's funny that it's actually, it must be perhaps one of those kind of four archetypes of, I guess like Three Musketeers as well, right? It's that similar kind of...
Yeah, that's, Three Musketeers is one of those four archetypes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With D'Artagnan as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I was just deliberately being sort of... I was deliberately being a prick about it for a comedic effect. It's fine. But then the other news is that they're talking about Tim... they're talking about trying to get Michael Keaton back to be Batman, which I think is probably the most exciting news. It made my brain explode when I was like, Michael Keaton? But they'll never do that. And in what context? And then they were like saying, not just Michael Keaton. It's not just a Michael Keaton cameo in a Flash movie. Who's the guy that plays the Flash? Do you remember what his name was?
I can't remember his name. I'm sure Natalie will sort it out. What is he called? No, it's gone.
Absolutely gone. poor guy. I'm sure he's listening in, just absolutely devastated. So it's kind of like, it's not just like a Michael. I've got to also flag up the fact that I've had 4 hours sleep. I'm absolutely exhausted. I was up last night working, and I had to get up early to do a DVD commentary with Oliver Harper, who was a guest on Fan Club last year. And I am just absolutely shattered. So my brain isn't working very well today. I'm just apologising to you, Nathaniel, and to the listeners at home. And later I'll be apologising to our guest. So it's not just like this little cameo from Michael Keaton. It's, they're talking about getting Tim Burton back to direct a standalone movie, which would be Batman Beyond, where an old Bruce Wayne takes... What's the name of the character?
Oh, God, what is he called? No, it's in terribly today.
It's not Tim Drake. Terry. No, Grant Gustin is not the Flash.
He's Flash on telly, is he?
I think he's Flash on telly. It needs to be from, like, the extended... Oh, my God, this is just an... This episode is falling apart by the fucking second.
It's Flash in the Justice League film.
The Justice League movie. I mean, I could just look it up on my phone.
You know, it's something like... Eliza? Ezra? Ezra Miller.
Ezra Miller, that's his name. What the fuck were we fucking talking about? This is a fucking car crash.
Batman Beyond, Natalie, maybe.
Batman. It's too long. It takes too long. You just keep talking. I'm looking it up. Terry McGinnis. Terry McGinnis, right? What the fuck was I fucking even talking about?
So Bruce Wayne is like Terry McGinnis's mentor in the future as an older Bruce Wayne, and they're set in, I guess, what was probably then 2020 or something, but it would now have to be 2040 or 20. Although Michael Keaton is actually going to be heading that way anyway, so they're probably, maybe they would set them in the present or the very near future.
Yeah, that's true. But why you can't do Batman Beyond? Well, you could do Batman Beyond if it was,
if you have a sort of...
If they bring Tim Burton back, it's Tim Burton imagining the future from where he made
Batman Returns and
Batman Returns. So it's like it's not necessarily our future.
Yeah,
it's the future as imagined by Tim Burton from 1989, which I just think is really fascinating.
Which is like a sort of 1940s, 1989 anyway, isn't it?
So yeah, yeah,
a lot of it's kind of art deco-y and lots of kind of film noir elements. People are wearing trench coats and things, but they've also got modern walkie-talkies and helicopters and things.
Yeah, you can't really bring back Michael Keaton without the aesthetic that Tim Burton brought, really. It's kind of like, it would be this weird thing. You can't just sort of like put Michael Keaton in a bat suit and let him walk around in the same universe that Wonder Woman is in without acknowledging the Burton universe that he created. So it's kind of really weird. And then because of the Tim Burton connection and the fact that Johnny Depp is in court at the moment and it looks quite positive in his direction, they're looking at getting Johnny Depp to come in and play the Joker. And you just think, there's sort of like a mock-up online of Johnny Depp with Joker makeup on, and it looks incredible. He looks like the closest thing to a Joker that he looks as close to the comic book a Joker as you've had.
Yeah, I can imagine.
That's what's really exciting. I just don't understand why they've never really got a comic book and done a faithful adaptation of Batman. It's kind of like everyone's gone, well, we all know what Batman is, so we'll just interpret it. And but no one's ever done like a direct transfer. Even the animated series, which is the best, is kind of based around the world that Tim Burton sort of created.
Yeah.
But takes it in a slightly more extreme direction, and it's less sort of like, it's less gothic and more film noir, but so there's never been kind of like this really faithful adaptation of Batman.
I remember when the film Mystery Men came out, I read a review of that. I think it was Kim Newman, former Fan Club guest, wrote it, and he was pointing out that it's funny now that they're doing a spoof in the kind of late 90s of like a superhero team when that hasn't really existed in cinema.
Yeah.
So it's almost like doing a spoof for a theatrical audience for something that only really exists in comics. And that's why it's sort of difficult to take a foothold in people's consciousness, because it doesn't really exist for people in the same way. You could probably do that now. Like, you could have Mystery Men now and people would be like, sure, I get it. But at the time, it didn't really work because it doesn't have the audience is struggling to latch onto it.
Yeah, but I also think that comic book movies don't actually take themselves that seriously anymore. The Marvel ones. And so there's a certain level of pastiche in what they do anyway. I mean, what was that one with Brendan Fraser in that's on TV?
Oh, Doom Patrol.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be quite sort of like, not necessarily tongue-in-cheek, but that seems to be kind of like acknowledging the fact that other superheroes exist. It is, so I think that Mystery Men kind of, I don't know, I think it's a flawed film, isn't it?
Mm. But I think it's a lot of very funny stuff in it. I guess it's just...
Ben Stiller's great in it.
It feels slightly out of time now. It does feel like a bit of a forgotten movie. And I wonder if that was why, really. It sort of kind of came out and went away again, didn't it? It wasn't really...
Well,
stuck in people's consciousness.
I remember I saw it at the cinema. I was at university. I saw it at the cinema. We went almost a Saturday morning. Maybe it was like midday, 11 o'clock in the morning, like a matinee. Watched it. We were the only people in the cinema. Maybe there's like two other people dotted around. And then we left. And it was, I enjoyed it. I thought Ben Stiller was great. It was just before Ben Stiller was like a megastar. Maybe he'd done something about Mary, because that came out when I was at school. But I don't think he'd kind of like done Meet the Parents at that point. Mm-hmm. I think maybe that came out the next year. So he wasn't sort of a megastar at that point. It was like the perfect version of him being angry. He was called Mr. Furious, right? So it was like the perfect combination of him kind of like... getting angry he was really good in it. I tell you what though, I mean, speaking of, because what we normally do is we go over what we've seen this week, I saw Happy Gilmore again this week, which has Ben Stiller in a small role. Ben Stiller's incredible in Happy Gilmore. Right, so this is the thing. I watched Happy Gilmore, and I watched Happy Gilmore quite regularly. Like, once a year, maybe once every couple of years, because I have, like, real nostalgia for it. I think Adam Sandler, it's a great Adam Sandler film. It's a really funny film. The jokes really work. And then the supporting cast is really good. You've got Christopher McDonald as Shooter McGavin, who's one of the best all-time screen villains. It's a funny film. And it's a really sweet film. One of the Adam Sandler films that I don't watch that often is The Wedding Singer. And I just remember The Wedding Singer being, like, really, really sweet. And then what was the other film I watched? Oh, Music and Lyrics. And I was just kind of like, right, well, so you've got Music and Lyrics on that side. You've got Happy Gilmore on that side. And then a combination of the two is you've got, like, 80s music and Drew Barrymore and then Adam Sandler in The Wedding Singer. And I really enjoyed Happy Gilmore. I think that that's held up really well as a film. And I just remember that The Wedding Singer is the bigger hit. That was kind of like his breakthrough into mainstream. Happy Gilmore was sort of like, he took all of his Saturday Night Live fans and he took them to the cinema. And then Wedding Singer was kind of like, me and my family went to see that at the cinema when that came out. That's what really made him. And I watched it and that has fucking aged like a fucking piece of fucking Gorgonzola next to the radiator at Christmas. I don't want to be like looking at old. I don't want to look at old films and be constantly going, well, that's problematic, and well, we can't say that anymore. Of course you can't. You know, I think the Gone with the Wind thing is kind of like this really confusing debate where no one's asking anyone to condone the behaviour of a film that was made 90 years ago. Oh, you know, condone the content of a film that was made 90 years ago and stand by it. But it's a document of the time and it's a film about the South during the Civil War. And so there's parts of it where you go, well, that's in the context of when it was made and what the film is about. You know, there are unpleasant things that are in there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't be looking at them. You know, when you look at something like The Wedding Singer, there's just that, it's just mean. There's just like fat jokes, and there's jokes about Alexis Arquette dressed up as Boy George, and it's kind of, there's a woman with sideburns in it, and it's just kind of like, it's just like relentlessly picks. I watched a thing online, and it was basically saying that there was a time when Adam Sandler was the underdog, when he was like lovable, and he was like the freak, right? And then there was a crossover period when he became like the bully. And you watch something like, and I'm a massive, like, not even an apologist, I'm a massive Adam Sandler fan, but when you rewatch The Wedding Singer, it is kind of like, yikes.
That's interesting. That's what I would quite like to see. I think about it a lot. I don't think I've seen it since it came out, but you're right. My memories of it is of quite a sweet film, quite a kind of good-natured kind of film.
And I think it is sweet, and it was sweet if you were a certain demographic. But I think at the time, because I was really bullied at school about being overweight and all this other stuff, and when you watch it and he's making fun of fat people in it, I just remember that I was kind of like at the cinema. I remember it kind of like it didn't feel right to me at the time. But then you overlook it because the rest of the film is so sort of like its heart is in the right place and they're kind of making jokes. And they're sort of trying to make fun of everyone, but they're not really making fun of everyone. So I think that, I don't want to say it's problematic, but there are sort of like some weird bits in it where out of the two, out of Happy Gilmore and The Wedding Singer, I would assume that The Wedding Singer is like a timeless classic. And it just feels like really dated. The other thing that really surprised me about it, in sort of a good way, but it's sort of a missed opportunity way, is that if you actually watch The Wedding Singer, like Steve Buscemi's performance in it is incredible. He's only got like this sort of extended cameo, but his performance in it is incredible, and it's like something out of an indie movie, yeah, where he's not just sort of like on, this is a cheapo Adam Sandler movie, I'm not really going to turn up for work today. Like maybe he would have done in sort of like Grown Ups or some of the later films, where Steve Buscemi just pops up in sort of like random cameos here and there. He actually turns in like a really great performance. And then when you actually look at the rest of the film, Adam Sandler's doing the same thing. Adam Sandler's putting in an actual, quite nuanced performance. And, you know, people go like, oh, it takes like a Punch Drunk Love or Uncut Gems for you to really see that Adam Sandler can do. He's good in The Wedding Singer. He's like, he puts in a really good, and it feels like the team around him, it feels like half of them were making one film and then the other half were making another film, or maybe they lost confidence. And in the edit, they just put in all of these random cutaways of like overweight people eating wedding cake and stuff like that, just so that they could kind of like, but the actual, what was the film that we were talking about like that, we were talking about this one film and then they kind of like, they sort of like mess it up in the edit. I think we were talking about it like last year.
Was it maybe the Ghostbusters film or something? That felt like something that was put together in.
No, it wasn't that. But maybe I'm having deja vu. My brain is not working properly today. But it was this thing where you watch it and then, and the film is an indie, a very sweet indie comedy, and then they put on very broad, like punchlines and endings to scenes that makes it feel like a more traditional Adam Sandler film. But if you actually look at the contents of the scenes and what's happening between them, there's actually kinds of like some really good performances in there.
Yeah, like, but you say, it felt like a more grown up Adam Sandler film. It felt like he was trying to cross over. It felt like a crossover film for him, and deliberately so. Like he was trying to do one that was going to be for a wider audience than usual.
Yeah, but it's still very much like Adam Sandler films have a certain tone to them. Like they try and do one thing, but then they're incredibly broad. You know, it's the sort of thing, like, I think it's set in 1985, and the reason it's set in 1985 is it's bang right in the middle of the 80s, where they can use stuff from the later 80s and they can use stuff from the early 80s, and it doesn't really matter because it's basically mid-80s. So they can do sort of like Miami Vice jokes, and but they're all superficial jokes. You know, there's just a guy walking in with his sort of like sleeves rolled up, and he says he's a big Miami Vice fan. And there's Flock of Seagulls haircuts, and there's the DeLorean, and she's dressed up as Madonna, and you know, this kind of not Drew Barrymore, Ben Stiller's wife. Christine Taylor. So it's kind of like they can reference all this stuff, and you kind of, that's fairly broad, but the performances are all pretty good. It was just weird. I just didn't assume that it would have kind of like, I thought it'd still be fairly watchable, but it's actually quite, it's quite unpleasant in places.
It doesn't surprise me overly, just because it isn't still around. Do you know what I mean? These things often have their own self-editing thing where it feels like something that I was like, oh, I should watch that again. But the fact it's never on TV, it felt like, you know, it felt like quite a big movie on its release. It never seems to have, like, lasted at all. It never seems to be around. No one talks about it anymore. It feels like it's naturally just gone away.
I think it's a weird one because it's, I think Adam Sandler fans will always revert back to Happy Gilmore or Billy Madison as their favourites, I think. And then Wedding Singer, people, I know a lot of women really like Big Daddy, which is the one where he like is a man child that adopts a kid. And so that's sort of like a favourite. And also 50 First Dates, I think, has probably aged a little bit better than The Wedding Singer, which was him and Drew Barrymore teaming up again. Mm-hmm. That's sort of, but I don't really hear many people saying that they really loved The Wedding Singer, which is kind of weird because it was a huge hit.
Yeah, I think for me, I felt at that time, at the time of his kind of height, I thought I was always a bit too good for Adam Sandler. Like, these films are quite trashy. And The Wedding Singer was probably the first one I went to see. And it was later when I'd sort of see... I didn't see, like, Happy Gilmore till it was on TV. And Big Daddy, I think, was another one I saw on TV and was... And just always struck by how good they were and how much I'd totally dismissed them. And I was like, I thought at that point they seemed like kind of quite cheap, quite trashy comedies and sort of overly broad. And I was a bit like, well, these aren't very good. It was only when I watched them. Happy Gilmore especially, I think.
I'm not a massive fan of Big Daddy, but I would say that I really like Happy Gilmore. And he also does a thing where he works with everyone's always sort of like he always gets sort of like a really sort of like A-list beautiful female lead to play his like girlfriend or his partner. But he kind of like hires people like Drew Barrymore, who was coming off of stuff like Batman Forever, so she wasn't a real big star at the time. And also she was an 80s kid, she was like E.T., so it kind of like works with the film. It's kind of like he's doing this retro thing. But then he worked with Winona Ryder when she was going through all of those legal problems, and then he worked with Jennifer Aniston after the Brad Pitt split up, breakup. And it's kind of like he does this thing where, yeah, he does work with, like, these A-lister women. It's either because they need the work at that time, or it's because he's... I think it's because he's, like, he's pretty decent. And that he's kind of giving people like an opportunity. Like Winona Ryder, nobody wanted to work with her really when they made Mr. Deeds. And he kind of like gave her that. I think Mr. Deeds is, because it's based on a, Mr. Deeds Goes to Washington. So it's a Frank Capra. It's because it's based on a Frank Capra movie. When Adam Sandler went and did Mr. Deeds, people went absolute batshit crazy. It gets like one star in Empire and one star in the Radio Times whenever it's on TV. People absolutely hate Mr. Deeds. I think it's great. I think it's really... I don't think it's necessarily as good as Happy Gilmore. But it is... I think it's a really funny film. It's probably his funniest film. It's funnier... I think it's funnier than Big Daddy. It's definitely funnier than The Waterboy. It's definitely fucking funny than Little Nicky. And then when you watch all of his Netflix things, you kind of like go, well, fucking hell. Little Nicky's a fucking masterpiece compared to the Ridiculous Six. But, yeah, anyway, I think the thing is that The Wedding Singer doesn't really appeal to diehard Adam Sandler fans in the same way that the other films do. And then I think in terms of people that really love romantic comedies, it's in the mix, but it probably doesn't stand up to other stuff which are maybe actual films that were made in the 80s, you know, like Pretty in Pink or Some Kind of Wonderful or Pretty Woman or When Harry Met Sally, you know. So when you actually compare it to those films are really kind of like, they don't have all that gross out humour that's sort of like hanging and on the underside of the movie. So it's... So it's not just a pure, sweet, romantic comedy. It's kind of like all this other stuff. I don't know. I just found it a little bit weird. Tell you what, guys, if anyone's watched Wedding Singer recently, write in and tell us what you think. It's time now to go to a fucking song!
She struts into the room. Well, I don't know her, but with a magnifying glance, I just sort of look her over. We have a drink or two, well, maybe three. And then suddenly, she starts telling me her life story.
And Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. Right, okay, I've got an energy kick, as I like to call it, another bite of noodles, but they're so spicy. I've got instant heartburn, so I'm tired, and now I'm deeply uncomfortable, and my mouth is burning, and my chest.
Yeah, that's water. Okay.
I've got water, but I'm just doing that thing where I'm just like gulping it down and now I feel like I'm going to be sick. I'm just having an absolute fucking nightmare today, Nathaniel. Oh, God. I've got 25 minutes to get better before our guest comes. It's all falling apart. So, what have you been a fan of this week?
What have I been a fan of? What have I been enjoying? I've been enjoying going out on the bike. I've been gifted a bike by former fan clubber David Trent.
I've got to say that just doesn't count. That'd be like me saying, oh, I've really enjoyed my Ubers this week.
But it isn't, because it's more passive being in an Uber. Yeah, being on a bike is like...
I love that. First time, as soon as lockdown's over, is it over? Who knows? I'm going to get a fucking Uber to Dundee. Do you know what I mean? I just love them. I love them so much. I've missed them. Oh, God, I miss an Uber. Oh, go on, tell us about your bike. I saw you on Sunday, didn't I?
I saw you on Sunday. I came to visit you. We met halfway. I went to the gardens opposite your house.
That's right. I walked out of my building. As we say, it's a very windy building. It's like a labyrinth in here. It takes quite a while to get out of the actual building. So it is about halfway, I would say.
Halfway.
That park, that decommissioned children's play park that's over the road from my flat. But it is about halfway, yeah.
It was a nice idea. I was really looking forward to it. As it happened, I did it on a day where, like, as soon as I got there, it pissed down. And then we're in the park, but I was just sat on a bike, and we couldn't really sit down because it was wet or do anything. So we just stood up, basically, and talked to each other. And basically did the equivalent of a Nick and Nat's fan club that no one will ever hear.
It was a really good one as well. I feel like that us talking about Tim Burton and Michael Keaton and Batman on Sunday when we did it the first time, it was really fresh then.
Yeah.
And it sort of, like, lacked the... I don't want to set a precedent where we're not allowed to hang out or see each other in between fan clubs. I don't want fan clubs to kind of like rule our social lives and dictate what we are allowed to do and say in our own personal private lives. But I think it is heading that way now, unfortunately. This week's show has suffered from the fact that we met up on Sunday.
We did meet up on Sunday, yeah. We haven't got that immediacy been able to do it. All we need to talk about is very deep things in person and very trivial things on the radio.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
Except that often goes that way where we meet up with each other and go, have you seen this? Did you see this? Have you heard this?
Well, that's all that happened, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was in the end, yeah.
I did ask you about, like, your family. And you said that your brother was making a toasted cheese sandwich and then had a funny turn. And then you told me all about that. But I really just wanted to know what was in the sandwich.
Right. Oh, no, that was before. That was when he had the COVID at the start of lockdown, wasn't it?
That's right. Well, I didn't want to go into the exact details in case you didn't want to go into the details. You know, this is just something that we can work out in our, you know. This is not for radio.
No, this is something we can do.
But you've been enjoying the bike that David Trent sent you.
Yeah, no, I really have, though. I really have.
You've talked about that fucking bike for 3 weeks in a row, and I have come up with new facts and figures.
You know what? I think the problem is, that you go, I haven't really been watching things, which is normally what I do. I normally waste my life watching films and things at home, and yet I've sort of got a thing that gets me out of the house.
Yeah. I tell you what I do, though. I think, I've got that fucking 2 hours to talk about pop culture every week. I better watch something.
You know what, though? No, I was thinking, before the show, I was thinking, yeah, I should do that, actually. I've got more things to talk about. Surfing on a bike.
No, it's good being on a bike, though. It's good being on a bloody bike. That's what I say. Well done. You know, bikes are like elephants, aren't they? They never forget. That's what they say. I'm sure I was a fan of something that was non... Right, so you ain't seen... Right, so tell us about your bike.
I'll tell you what is good, actually. I'll tell you what I did the other day. I went up to M&S on my bike.
Yeah.
And I went to the M&S in Stratford Westfield. And, you know, I worked, there's lots of people going into your TK Maxx's there. And I went, oh, that looks busy. That looks a bit horrendous. Don't really want to get involved in all the big crowds. So I went to the M&S food bit to get a bag full of shopping. And I noticed that straight opposite the M&S, there is a WH Smiths, and there's not a lot of people going into WH Smiths. So I pop into WH Smiths, have a look around. WH Smiths, Stratford Westfield have still got mini eggs and Cadbury's cream eggs. Got a pack of mini eggs with me now. 50p. Mini eggs.
Nat.
Hmm?
I'm going to fucking kill you. I can't believe that. Fucking Carl Reiner died this week.
He did.
people that are younger than what? 30? No, probably. Well, when did Blockbuster close?
Yeah, I reckon. Oh, yeah, it could be early 2000s, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, no, because we still went to Blockbuster when we were at university, I think. But, like, in the 80s, like, going into the video shop, I mean, I'll tell you this story. We had Mixed Video that was at Whitecroft in St Albans. I think it's an Indian takeaway now. But Mixed Video used to be kind of, like, in between sort of a super, like an off-license and a fish and chip shop, which was also a Chinese restaurant. And so, like, Friday nights, you'd kind of, like, go down to the... Like, video shops were amazing. They were just absolutely... They were, like, a thing of absolute joy and wonder. And I do sort of feel sorry for people that are just growing up scrolling through Netflix. Because a video shop would be something like you'd go there, there'd be a limited choice, but not that limited. And they would have all sorts of fucking films that you'd never even heard of. And the artwork was really incredible and everything. And the scary stuff would be at the top, that so you couldn't reach it. Or there'd be a horror section, which I'd never go into because it was really small as well. It was like a horseshoe shape where you'd go in and there was an aisle. There was like a set of shelves in the middle of the room and the counter at the end. And you go up to the counter and then there'd be the second half of the shop. And the horror section was down there. Or there's like an adult section. I'd never go down there because I was sort of like six or seven. And I just spent hours looking at these videos. And I remember there was a poster for Naked Gun, or there was like a cardboard cutout for Naked Gun in the window. And I sort of put together that the guy on the poster for Naked Gun was the same guy as the guy on the poster for The Man with Two Brains. Even though obviously they weren't. And we'd sort of like, you'd be able to rent stuff out. And I love Steve Martin. I love Steve Martin, I think, because there were so many Steve Martin films out in the 80s that every week you'd go in there and you'd just pick up a new Steve Martin film. And because you were young, you know, they were all good, you know. You'd get like Three Amigos out and you'd watch it on the Friday and then you'd watch it again on the Saturday. And I think maybe you were allowed to rent them out for the weekend. It wasn't just overnight. And so you'd watch it one more time on the Sunday and then you'd take it back and then you'd tell your friends about it on the Monday. And I just remember that Carl Reiner, he made The Jerk with Steve Martin, and then he made The Man with Two Brains, and then they made Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid and All of Me. Those are like the four big ones. I was never such a huge fan of All of Me, although I saw it again at the cinema recently and I do think it is good. But The Jerk doesn't feel like a complete film, but it sort of tails off a bit in the second half, but it's got so many outstandingly funny moments in it. And Bernadette Peters is absolutely just gorgeous. And the song Tonight You Belong to Me is incredible. And Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid is maybe my favourite film that they made together, which is just the most technically difficult, where they splice black and white footage of Steve Martin into old films like The Maltese Falcon. And he gets to act with people like Vincent Price and James Stewart from all these old films. And Carl Reiner was 98 when he died. So it's kind of like he was very old. And he was really sort of like political right up to the end. He was anti-Trump. There's a really beautiful picture of Carl Reiner with his daughter and Mel Brooks. And they're all wearing Black Lives Matter T-shirts and all like laughing together. I just think he was a great guy. And also he was Rob Reiner's dad. And Rob Reiner is obviously, I think, maybe one of the most important or greatest film directors of the 1980s. Like on a par with someone like Spielberg, I would say Rob Reiner's output was consistently good. Anyway, I just sort of like just giving a shout out to Carl Reiner, really, because
I think Carl Reiner was one of the first directors I knew, weirdly, as well, from those films. Like, it was that I would think of them as Steve Martin, Carl Reiner films. I think when I was little, I think I almost assumed Carl Reiner might be like a pseudonym for Steve Martin, because sure, I just associated them so much together. And Carl Reiner was this name. But I didn't know any of his sort of history at that point. It was like, Carl Reiner makes Steve Martin films.
How could you? But like, it's just one of those things about the video shop was like this really important place to me, where I didn't have loads of friends to play around with at the weekend. And I was new to St. Albans, so it wasn't kind of like, I didn't have all these friends that I'd grown up with through school. And the video shop, I was just always happy when I was in there. And yeah, I discovered all of these My whole taste in films and my obsession with films and my taste in comedy, it all sort of like stems from either my parents or to the video shop where you kind of like developed your own tastes. And through that, you know, you'd get... I mean, it was a great time to be growing up because it was sort of like you'd have stuff like I say, Three Amigos, but then you'd have stuff like Spaceballs and you'd have kind of more like the trashy stuff like License to Drive and... Teen Wolf, and you know, they're all kind of like these amazing films that sort of like shape your life when you're growing up. And they basically work better in a video shop than they do in a cinema.
Yeah, they have like on the back of magazines at the time, I guess like Sunday magazines, they would probably be like Free with the Papers. There would always be these adverts of just like you just have the little video boxes, and they would be like sort of it would be like all the Arnie movies all in a row, and it would be like all the Steve Martin movies all in a row. And it did feel like they were all part of something. It felt like they felt less at the time like individual movies and more like a collection.
Yeah.
Like you buy your Arnie movies and you buy the Steve Martin movies, which were also all everything at that point. All those films on the back were also Carl Reiner movies. And I guess Carl Reiner is to Steve Martin, in my mind, what someone like Hal Roach is to Lauren Hardy. It's the name above those films that make you go, Carl Reiner. I mean, and I guess it's stuff like, I guess he also had that slightly second wind, didn't he, with the Ocean's 11 movie, and they kind of brought him back, didn't they, to sort of a more sort of mass audience again and introduced him as this sort of comic figure in those movies. Yeah, yeah, such a huge presence, isn't he? And I think, I think, For us, I mean, even more so in the States, I think, with those kind of, the stuff he did with Mel Brooks, yeah, Mary Tyler Moore show and Dick Van Dyke show and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, if all he ever did were those Steve Martin movies, it's enough, you know? I mean, it's...
yeah.
It's huge.
Absolute legend in shaping who I am. And... yeah, I just think, yeah, him and Rob Reiner, really. But yeah, anyway, it's sad to, but he, you know, it's sad on the level that he's not around anymore, because I think he was actually a really great person. But also, I'm just very grateful that he made those films, and they got me through a lot of the 80s. So, and I still watch them now. I watched The Jerk the other week. And The Man with Two Brains, I think, improves over time, really. So, yeah, good. Well, the ending to that story about the fucking video shop is, though, we went into Mick's video shop every week. And, like, to the point where I'd rent out Army of Darkness every week, and then he'd let me get it, even though it was a 15 and I was 12, because... he knew that my mum knew that I'd already seen it anyway. There was no point in not letting me have it because I'd definitely seen it, you know. And just used to go to the video shop all the time. Then Blockbuster opened, and then Mix didn't really have the selection. So we sort of like had Blockbuster as a backup, but we'd always make sure that we went to Mix. But then Mix sort of like fell behind on all of the selection that he got. And then eventually you just like go, well, Blockbuster, they also sell sweets. And then it was just like this thing you could actually, I felt so guilty about it at the time. But there was this crossover period between using like the local video shop and then actually just slowly drifting over to the big corporation. And it was like a dirty secret where you'd go into Mix every so often, but you knew he didn't really have the selection anymore. And one day my dad was in charge of taking the video back. And... I think basically he delivered Mix Video to Blockbuster, and Blockbuster had to phone up Mix Video and say, oh, this has been delivered. And he had to phone us up. And then after that, he knew that we betrayed him.
And cheated on Mick.
And I could never look him in the eye ever again. I felt so ashamed. Which was actually the instigation for us to go to Blockbuster. But it's great, they had video games as well. They had all sorts.
So it all worked out in the end.
It worked out in the end. I don't know what happened to Mick, but it's an Indian restaurant now, so it's great. No, I always felt terrible about that, really. But you'd go to get a copy of The Rock out, and he wouldn't have it. But they'd have 20 copies of Blockbuster, and that's basically how Blockbuster did it, wasn't it? Mm. Anyway, so I feel awful about that still to this very day. But it's time for fan mail now, isn't it? So we're all right. Okay, so play the music, maestro. Are you playing it? Yeah, it's playing it. I feel terrible now. Hello, you lovely boys. Oh, hang on. It's too much water. Oh, my God, I got such bad heartburn. Hello, you lovely boys. I heard last week that Johnny Vegas took a shit in a can of Pringles. Lol. If I can ask, what is the weirdest loo situation that you've ever experienced? Thanks, Clara. The weirdest loo situation I've ever
been. That's an odd question. Weirdest loo situation. Are they basically asking us where's the weirdest place you've had a shit? I think I'm lucky and I can't think of any terrifying stories. I think I'd...
I have no strange, unusual toilet stories. Yeah. Sorry to say.
Because I was ill, I had to give a stool sample in at my doctor's. And you give it in a little tube, you know. So you've got to kind of, like, shit in a tiny tube and take that along to the doctor.
You want me to shit in the tube?
Well, you're meant to, I guess, put a bit of shit into the tube.
Yeah, you're not meant to... It's impossible to actually...
No, you can't.
I mean...
From one tube to another.
I did a stand-up show about this. You're not meant to shit in the tube.
No. I guess that would be like putting toothpaste into another toothpaste.
It comes with a little chisel that you're meant to...
Scoop it out with. Yeah, it's very much like a Haagen-Dazs kind of shot.
It's like a cinema ice cream. Anyway, go on.
And then I had to take it from... It's probably a 5-10 minute walk to the doctor's. I had to take it along to the doctor's. And as you're going along, you think... One of the horrible things about it is, of course, that when you put the stopper on, but the shit itself is warm, so your tube kind of steams up, for one. And then you're sort of walking along, and you realise you're walking along and you've got shit in your pocket. It's in a tube, but you walk along with shit in your pocket. And I kept thinking, God, imagine if I get mugged now. That's what I kept thinking. This would be the great time to get mugged and to go. But I think I'd be like, no, you can't have it. Because I'd be almost too ashamed to go, I've got shit in my pocket.
You'd have to, what, you'd get stabbed.
Yeah. Because I wouldn't want to show a mugger that I've got like a Haagen-Dazs serving of shit in my pocket in a tube, in a plastic tube.
Well, I hope you're happy with that, Clara. Dear Mr. Helm and Mr. Mecca, who wants to know about other people's toilet stories? As if I've got, like, any to hand that I can... I've basically got the exact same story as Nathaniel, except for when I was delivering it, the woman behind the counter at the doctor's went... Oh, you're an uncle. And I was like, no. No, of all the time, all the times to be recognised. Dear Mr. Helm and Mr. Metcalf, have you ever eaten cheese? I never have, but it seems popular, so I'm pondering whether I should give it a little thought, please. Thank you in advance, Mr. T. Start with cheese strings, they're fucking delicious.
You were talking about cheese strings the other day. You just started, didn't you? You've not had them before.
I had a fucking cheese string and they're fucking absolutely...
You've been wasting your life, haven't you?
Absolutely wasted. I don't know what I've been doing all my life. Cheese strings are absolutely fucking incredible. They're like fish sticks, only with cheese. They're absolutely fucking delicious. Nick Helm, I am 5'9". I heard what you said regarding people my height. Well, I'll have you know, you are absolutely correct. We are all cunts and I am the biggest of them all. Thanks, Mr. Cunt. I told you, if you're 5'9" and you're listening to this, you better pray you're 5'8" or 5'10", because if you're 5'9", it's official. You are a cunt. That's not just me saying that. That's also confirmed by Mr. Cunt, who wrote in this week. You've just heard the message. Hello, you crazy carrots! I would like to set up a YouTube channel and become one of those influencers, because that seems to be where the money is these days. Do you have any thoughts what my USP could be? I like balloons, tissue, slightly smelly feet, and Tom Hardy. Thanks, Tone. Well, Tone, I think that's an adventure and a journey that every YouTuber has to go on their own. Trial and error, that's the way forward. AKA, I don't want to engage with you. Long time listener, first time caller, / emailer. Hi, Nick and Nathaniel Metcalf, love the show. It helps me get to sleep at night. That's a bit
I don't know how I feel about that.
Bit of a neck. However, recently, what with this hot weather and all, I find myself getting to the... What with this hot weather and all, I find myself getting to the end of an episode and still being awake. This got me thinking. What is your favourite weather-based movie, Groundhog Day? Mine is Twister. I love a bit of Bill Paxton, or is that Bill Pullman? Paxton. I always get the two mixed up, as you do. Don't. It just so happens that Twister is also my favourite mat-based party game and iced treat. Heck, I kind of lost my train of thought, but keen to know both. I mean, it's Groundhog Day. Heck, I kind of lost my train of thought, but keen to know both your opinions. I value them dearly. Jeff. P.S. Told my friend about your show. Not sure if he's listened to it, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
This is Jeff or Chris?
I don't know. That's weird. He's got two surnames.
What's your favourite weather-based film? What's your favourite weather-based film, Nat? What is it? What's your favourite weather-based film? Mine's Groundhog Day. What's yours?
I like the film Night of the Big Heat.
Oh, fuck off. As if you've ever seen that. Hey, Nick. It's either Groundhog Day or Die Hard with a Vengeance. It's so hot in that movie. Hey, Nick and Nat. I must say I'm a huge fan of Disney films. Do you like Disney films as well? I recently rewatched The Emperor's New Groove. Great movie.
Great movie.
I absolutely loved it. What are your thoughts on it? Cheers, Clem. Just don't talk about films when you meet... What? Something's gone wrong there. Yeah, Emperor's New Groove is really great. I do like Disney films. I would say my favourite Disney film is probably Sleeping Beauty, which I think is stylistically incredible. And I also think that my other one would be, I don't know, Beauty and the Beast, but I watched it once and I didn't like it as much as I used to, so maybe I've got to stop watching that. But I really like Emperor's New Groove. I think it's great.
Pinocchio, I think, but I do also really recommend Emperor's New Groove.
It's David Spade being excellent. And yes, I really do love... oh, God, but yeah, I think Pinocchio is great. That's probably my favourite of that era, but also Sleeping Beauty is, oh God, what a movie. It's just beautiful to look at. It's got this really cool artistic style to it. Yeah, here you go. Anyway, I hope you have a lovely day, Clem. Goodbye. Right, our guest is waiting, so it's time to play a song. I'm going to have a wee, and then we're going to talk to our guest.
I'll have a wee too.
Oh, well, hopefully something hilarious will happen and we can tell whatever that cunt was called about it.
Man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. These things I know. A father only loves his own, these things I know. But a mother is a sweet thing, these things I know. A grandmother shows accommodation, these things I know. But a god can only speak to his own. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. These things I know. Sometimes we must leave the city. These things I know. Your verse may lie if your chorus is pretty. These things I know. Everyone believes the wiki. These things I know. The city smells, but so does the countryside. Some say peace, but they mean submission. Truth can be sticky. It's your truth, you're stuck with it. Wrongs cannot be righted without changing another's traditions. They'll change their ways, but only if you resist their insistence. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me a tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. Tale man, tell me the tale of your life, for I'm sure it is a good one. These things I know. A jealous God means a jealous priesthood. These things I know. When the visionless lie asserts itself. These things I know. A jealous priest is a deadly enemy. And these things I know. A deadly enemy serves you better dead. Tale man, tell me what's wrong with my life. Am I only here to question? No, sir, you are undoubtedly here to cajole and make suggestion. With the weird light shining in your eyes, even hell would never see.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back! My name is Nick and Helm, and this is...
still Nathaniel Metcalf.
And now we are joined in Camp COVID by our best friend and soon to be yours, Mr. Harry Hill!
No, applause. You get that on, you get that on Steve Wright.
It did feel like we should have put some applause in there, but we might do it in post.
Oh, we'll fix that in post. How are you both?
It's good. I mean, we're not keeping up with the zoo radio atmosphere of Steve Wright in the afternoon. Does he still have a posse, Steve Wright, or does he have one man now?
He has a remote posse.
Okay.
Yeah. He has, I actually haven't been in for a while. I do listen in.
Yeah, the socially distanced posse.
Yeah. They are. well, we all have to take precautions now, of course, with this global pandemic.
What are we talking about?
Steve Wright, we're just wondering, he tends to have a posse of people that cheer him in the studio.
Well, actually, what it is, it's on a tape. In normal times, when they're sitting there, so I've forgotten his name. Anyway, and Janie Lee Grace, Shirley's first wife, he says, he does this run through, oh, we got Harry Hill in the studio. And he presses the button and there's applause. But they don't, even move. They just sit there like that.
Well, really, what you've got to do, Harry, is get over the fact that you're not on Steve Wright's show and you're on a different show. And we do things differently around here.
Yeah, so I noticed.
You've just got to change gear in your head and then just kind of like just lie back and enjoy it. Hello, Harry. How are you?
Hi, Nick. I'm very well. Yeah, it's great to be on
what?
Our radio. What's it? Foobar.
It is, yeah.
Not Furby Radio.
What have you been up to?
Should I do that? I've done this joke before on The Last Leg. You know, I'm sharing with Chris Whitty, the chief science officer. Okay. Do you want me to do that again? Chris. I'm sharing with Chris Whitty.
I see.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. Don't go out, wash your hands.
I think those jokes have stopped.
I think those jokes have been past it now, Harry.
Do you think, Chris? yeah.
Sure.
I've got this new one, actually. You know, I have a sort of collection of ventriloquist dummies.
So this is radio. So,
yeah. Oh, okay, yeah.
So that was the ventriloquist doll that you just brought up?
Yeah. Perhaps I'm the wrong guest for this show. I'm very visually minded.
I mean, you are quite visual, and yes.
I got, my old producer friend, Alan Thorpe, Nick?
Sure, yes.
He sent me his family ventriloquist dummy, which is a little boy in a flat cap, and I repainted him.
Who's that meant to be?
I thought it could be Chris's wife. Oh, Chris, you left the nessie in the bathroom again. You know, I thought it'd be funny that if Chris Whitty had like a really sort of aggressive northern wife that we never see.
Sure, but you will see her now because you've made her.
That she's what?
You've made her, so
yeah.
you will get to see her now.
Yeah.
So
they do look like they belong to the same family of ventriloquist puppets.
Yeah.
They've got a very similar facial similarity. They look more like relations. They look like they could be brother and sister.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. I think there is a certain.
Oh no! But... Yeah, you're right.
I think there's a common look to Vents. It's joking aside, ventriloquists are having the toughest time of all people in this pandemic because A, they have to keep 2 meters apart, and B, they have to wear a mask. So this could be.
It's going to be the end. Oh, you're right.
Could be the end of ventriloquism.
I think actually that actually means that anyone could be a ventriloquist now if you're wearing masks.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know,
if everyone can do it, then where's the skill?
Yeah,
that's the real. Yeah, thanks, Harry, for coming on and shining a light on the true victims of COVID. The ventriloquists out there.
Maybe so your hair's grown as well in lockdown.
What's that?
Your hair's grown in lockdown.
Yeah, the hair's grown back.
Mm.
It's a real drag. Actually,
it's almost like it's a similar style to Stevie Wonder's. He's got a similar haircut. Or who else looks a bit like that? Terry Nutkins, I guess, would have had a similar.
It's actually Max Wall.
Of course, Max Wall.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you what it is. I bought this. I sent off for this wig. And because I'm doing this, I had been working on a new thing, a caveman act. So this is my caveman wig. I only did it twice, and the first night it came off, so I put a chin strap.
But did you buy the wig, or did you make the wig?
I bought the wig, yeah.
And they make it so that, what, it just falls off? Or are you meant to glue it onto your head?
I think you're not supposed to sort of throw yourself around in quite the way that I was. That was required to get the necessary laughs.
Okay. And is that a live thing that you're doing on stage?
That was the thing I was looking forward to doing this year, particularly. And what happened was, I did one... Basically, the idea of it is... I'm a caveman, right? Have we talked about this before? I think we have, haven't we?
I think you've told me about it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell your listeners. So I had this idea that if I could do a show that was silent... Not silent, but no words, no spoken words, right? So I thought I could do it, or I could get someone to do it, and it could open, because there were no words in it, it could open in every major city in the world, Moscow, Helsinki, Beijing, Paris, other ones.
Sure.
And it would be hugely lucrative. And so I wrote this thing. They'd be playing simultaneously all around the world. New York, Colombo.
Well, you'd franchise it out.
Well, I wasn't going to be in it.
Right, okay.
Right. So I wrote this thing. I took it round to various West End producers, and they just sort of read it. It doesn't read like anything because there's no words. It's like, you know, caveman walks on, caveman sees a bird, tries to eat the bird, you know, and they're just looking at it like, what's this? They said, you've got to be in it. To sell any tickets, you'd have to be in it.
Which has annoyed you, right?
So I thought, oh, all right then. So I thought, yeah, all right. So then I started to get into it. And I got your friend, Paul F. Taylor.
Yeah.
Well, my friend too.
Do you know what? I think Paul F. Taylor's told me about this rather than you.
Yeah, what did he say?
He says he loves it.
He played a dinosaur. So I did basically, and I got Holly Byrne, you know, the brilliant Holly Byrne.
Yeah, Holly Byrne's incredible.
To play a cave woman. I mean, the thing I've got planned is a big show. You know, it involves some, you know, flying in and big props and all kinds of stuff. But basically, I did like a cut-down 40-minute version at the Battersea Arts Centre. We kind of rehearsed it for a week. There's loads of music and sound effects, and so it's not silent. And they said, oh, well, you know, you can let some people in to watch it on the first... You know, if you want to, you could get let people in. It was in that little, like a... I think they call it the library.
Right.
It's just like a square room. And so he did that, right? And he sort of advertises Harry Hill, caveman. And then we're about, I don't know, it was full, but it was like, I mean, obviously it was full. It was about 40...
not obviously. No. But sure.
It was about 40 people. And it starts with... I've got this cardboard rock that I made, right? And it starts, the lights go down, and I appear from behind the rock in that wig. I have like a painted beard, you know, like a monobrow, and a caveman fur dress, you know.
Loincloth thing.
Well, more, yeah, that sort of with a club, and they're just looking at me, and obviously I'm not speaking. They're just looking at me like, what is this? And when's it going to stop? Literally, for the first 10 minutes.
You would think that would be when you've got your period of grace, right? Your first 10 minutes would be where everyone's excited to see you. It's a small room.
Yeah.
Come to Harry Hill's Caveman.
Yeah.
You've come out. And so far, I'd say it's their fault. You've delivered on all promise.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that situation where you're trying, you know, basically, I'm in the caveman outfit. There's no way out. I've got to see it. You know, I've got to go all the way to the end. It's not like with new material where you can think, right, that joke didn't work, I'll put an old one in to bring them back round. And so I'm right there, you know, I'm kind of 55 years old. You know, it's like 5:30 in the afternoon. And I've got this, just like a cold sweat dripping down my back, thinking, what the hell are you doing? But they sort of came round. All I'd say is there were a few bits I thought, yeah, there's some hope here. And obviously when it's over, you have this huge relief when it's over. And you forget the sort of the difficult bits. So I went away, rewrote it. And we did it at the... we had 5 nights booked in, so like a month later, 6 weeks later, in Surbiton. You know those Math Brown gigs?
Yeah.
And we did the first one on the Friday, right? And it was...
Can I just ask, is it you, Paul and Holly that are all turning up together to do this show?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's it called?
I've come on as the caveman. It's just called I Am Caveman.
And when was this year?
This is... Well, it was the Friday before they closed all the...
Oh, right. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and the Math Brown gigs there again. They're like what sort of 50 seaters, aren't they? In
yeah, that was it. Was that little theatre in Surbiton? So actually, and it was anyway. It couldn't have gone better than it couldn't have gone better, right?
Right.
So it was really, really exciting. All three of us came off thinking, great. You know, we've got another one on Monday. And then we were due to do Finchley Arts Depot on the Thursday, which is like 350 or something, you know. So it was like, oh, great, this is going to... And you know what it's like when you've got a bit of confidence and the whole thing starts to really... It's the kind of fun bit, but...
I've heard people talk about that sort of stuff, yeah. But I tell you, never heard it firsthand, but yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, we couldn't do it. So it's just, it's an odd sensation. I did video it, fortunately.
But what happens now? Do you get to do you have any clue? Do you just get to do it in the autumn? Do you then?
Well, it won't be the autumn, will it? I think it's.
I guess yes, of course.
Yeah, the problem is as soon as the problem is as soon as the lockdown, as soon as they open the theatres, you can be sure that every single 2-bit comic in Britain is going to be on tour.
I am.
No one's earned any money.
No, absolutely. Well, that's the thing. It's kind of like when lockdown first started, it was kind of, well, Nick, we're going to have to reschedule your tour. And it's just like, that's great. But everyone that was on tour is rescheduling their tours. And so then there was sort of like, you have to fight to get theatre space in the first place when you're booking a tour. And then you had to refight to do it because everyone was basically trying to reschedule it for as soon after lockdown might finish as possible. You know, it might be that you'd have to delay your tour by like 4 months or 6 months. I'm delaying mine by a year.
I think it's going to be a year probably, isn't it?
Well, it's not going to be this year. We're not going to be back touring again. We're not going to be back gigging again this year. It doesn't
matter. So now what I'm thinking is I might I've written it up as a little film.
Yeah.
So, but I'd have to get, you know, it's quite a big thing, isn't it, organising all that. So, you know,
But isn't the joy of it to be performing it live?
Well, because I think there's two things. I think there's two ways. I think, yes, absolutely. That's the idea. That's the whole point of it, is to do it live. And there's a lot of audience participation.
And as soon as you start filming stuff and getting other people involved, then it becomes more and more complicated.
Yeah.
Do you have those problems? Because I find...
You don't have to record any sound with it. That's all the only...
I know, but I'm talking more about like other people kind of putting their opinions into it. Because I don't know if you find it at your stage in your career, but every time you want to get anything made, there's sort of like a series of hoops that you need to jump through in order to get it, and then it sort of like dilutes the original idea. So doing something live is kind of like the purest form of doing it.
Yeah. Well, this is the weird, this is the sort of, I mean, actually, you've chosen a good day to talk to me about, I mean, not a good day, a bad day. For, I've been working on this TV, this clip show for the BBC, and so far they've been good as gold, but I just got all these notes through on this, on one particular episode. I just like, I think, I feel like crying, just because you... The point you make, right, and you're absolutely right, the fantastic thing about stand-up, live performance or whatever, is you don't answer to anyone. You say what you like, you do what you like, you know, you turn up, you don't, you know, in some situations you don't even have a bag with you. It's just you and your voice.
Yeah.
Right? You could just drive across there, walk in, and you're off. And that is what the TV people liked about you. Right?
Yeah.
When they first saw you, oh, love this, love his voice, love the voice of Nick Helm. We love
the whole package. We don't have to do anything.
We love the whole package. And then they think, but maybe I could improve it. You know. That's the problem. That is the problem. You know, and I think it's a big problem. And actually, it never bothered me before. You know, I never used to get any notes. It's only since I got the hang of it that people started to wade in.
Is that success? Is the higher you go up the ladder, the more hands are involved in it?
I think actually, it's been a change in the people who are in charge. Mm-hmm. In many, I think that's right. You may be right. Maybe I think, you know, it may be that expectations are different and all the rest of it. But my feeling is that the people giving the notes are a different type of person. So what it used to be, what I found in the past was that people would just leave you alone, and if it didn't work, you'd just get cancelled.
Mm.
Right. Which I think we can all live with.
I think that's fair as well. It's that almost like it doesn't fair. Work, or it doesn't. It works for that audience, or it doesn't. It works for an audience at 10:30 p.m., or it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. But now it's, and I think those people weren't. I don't know. They weren't. I don't know where these people have, the people in charge now have come from. I think they're kind of career. You know, TV executives, you know, they've always slightly got their eye on the next project. You know, one of the end of this, but out of that. And so they're trying to manage their career as much as the show.
Yeah.
No one takes a risk. Everyone's so risk averse.
I think that there is sort of like that element where you are a factor into the decision-making, but you're not the... Can I tell you a story about when I was making Heavy Entertainment?
Yeah, please.
When I did a radio pilot at Christmas in 2013, or Christmas 2012, which basically off the radio pilot, they gave me a TV pilot for Heavy Entertainment, which was sort of like a light entertainment thing, is what they wanted. They wanted my stand-up show on TV, right? They wanted my stand-up act on TV. So it's like a light entertainment sort of vehicle. I did the series, I did the pilot, and it was what it was, but we had like 3 weeks to do it. And there was some good stuff in it and some stuff that I just thought, there's no way that'll stretch to a series, but we'll work it out. And then they offered me the series and I went in and we were working with this this executive. And we'd sort of like been working on this thing for 3 months where we'd been writing stuff and I'd kind of like was developing the series. It's this light entertainment series. Every episode's going to be about a different theme. And they were like saying, yeah, it's really good, Nick. It'd be really good if you had some sort of like some sort of structure or some sort of something that gives like a backbone to the whole series. And I started saying, oh, right, okay. Well, I think that each scene is sort of, each episode is sort of self-contained. And they said, yeah. You sort of like play a game in one of the episodes, don't you? And I said, yeah. And they said, it'd be great if you played the game in every episode. And I was just like, well, I don't think we should play the game in every episode, but I certainly think that if you played it in one episode, it would stand out. And they said, yeah, okay. And I said, but if you wanted me to put some sort of like, I think the reason why the game episode works is because it's so different from all the others. And they were like, yeah, okay. And then they come back a bit like a week later and they're like saying, now, yeah, I really think that it needs sort of like this element, that game that you're doing, you know, that game that you do. I think there's really something about that. And I'm just like going, well, I don't really understand why you keep bringing up the game. And they go, no, it's all right, it's up to you, you know. But I just think having some sort of like game show kind of element, and I'm like saying, whoa, you're like saying game show now, like it's an actual, this is a light entertainment thing that we've been spending 3 months writing. And then we have another meeting like 2 weeks later and they're like going, yeah, this game show thing that this is going, and I'm not going, hang on a minute. Anyway, that guy went for a promotion and then he left the project because he didn't get the promotion. And we get a new guy that's in charge and he's like going, so I think that we need to look at this sort of game element. And I said, whoa, what's this game element? And he goes, look, no one's saying game show, right? No one's saying game show. And I'm sort of like saying, look, I'm not saying game show. And if you're not saying game show, then why is everyone saying game show all the time, right? We've done a pilot that isn't a game show. We've got like this series. And it turned out that basically they were trying to sort of like turn this light entertainment show into a game show.
Game show.
And it was kind of like, and then what, it turned out that someone at top at BBC wanted a game show. And they were like, well, we've got this project right here. We could change this into a game show. And my whole thought about it was, if you want a game show, just ask me for a game show and I'll write a game show. But this is a light entertainment show. This is a different thing. That's kind of like a square peg in a round hole, you know? And it turned out that I think Joe Lycett did a pilot for the game show that they did in the end. And it didn't get commissioned. And then he went off the idea of having a game show. And then they just let us make the series. But it was just like this thing where it wasn't anything to do with our show. It was this thing that was floating around that someone wanted a game show. So they just tried to turn projects that weren't game shows into game shows.
Yeah, I haven't had that experience.
I don't know if anyone else has.
But, you know, the thing with, I think what you have to remember about TV is it is a bit of a game. Not a game show, but it's a bit of a game. And you sort of have to be prepared to give them a little bit and allow a little bit of you to die each time.
Yes, absolutely. But I do also think that it's important.
It's a lot of people. Yeah, go on.
I just think it's important that everyone knows what show they're making when they start. Because if someone wants a game show and you go into a meeting and they say, Nick, we're looking for a game show. Then you can go away and you can go, game show, got you. I'll come up with a game show. But you can't go in and say, oh, I've developed this light entertainment series with music and dancing and singers and stand-up and stories and, you know. And then they go, yeah, but can you make it into a game show? But not even tell you they want a game show. Sort of try and sort of like use a Jedi mind trick on you. To only get you to convert into, and just say what you want and we'll do it.
I think that a big part of it is to make them think that they're getting what they want.
But they could get what they want.
I mean, when I did, like, the first few series of TV Burp, every series they would say to me, we're going to cancel it. At the start of each series, and there's no exaggeration, my then keepers, Avalon, would say to me, they don't like it, they're going to cancel it, which is really good for morale. All right? And so one of the ideas, I had to go into this meeting with IT. One of the things they kept saying was, this is the first year, they kept saying, no one knows who he is. Me, right?
Hmm. Can I just, when was the first series?
2001 or 2000, around that time.
And when did your Channel 4 series finish?
Oh, about a year. I think it was about a year when I was sort of out of work. That's when I wrote my first book. it was about a year.
And then how many series of TV Burt did you make eventually?
11.
So that's
13, you...
maybe 13. I mean, it was 11, it was 10 or 11 years. But the first one, they say, no one knows who he is. Can he go on other shows so people know who he is, right? Then they said, can he get celebrities on? What we need is to see some celebrities on. Maybe we could cut to, maybe Lorraine Kelly or someone could do a line, so it would go to Lorraine Kelly and she'd say, oh, Harry, I noticed this week on EastEnders that, Barbara Windsor's handbag looks like a face, right? So I said, yeah, okay, yeah, we can do that. So we would do this and we would film these things. I think a couple of them did go out where they would say, oh, hi, Harry. I'd say, we get to Lorraine Kelly, and she'd be in the street and she'd say, oh, hi, Harry. I don't know if you noticed that, Barbara Windsor's handbag looks like a face this week. But of course they would kill the joke, because they couldn't deliver it. And also it was completely at odds with the whole sort of idea, because the whole sort of feel of that show was me, being anti.
Yeah, anti-celebrity.
Yeah. But so we just quietly, after we did it a couple of times and then quietly dropped it and no one raised it, right? And then have I told you this? Then the final one was they said, you've got to go in for a meeting with the head of ITV, who was Simon Shapps at the time. He doesn't like the name TV Burt, right? So this is like 4 or 5 series in, right? He wants us to change the name, right? So, and by then, I'm just sick of it. I'm quite happy to just say, all right, forget it. So we go in. So I say to my manager, I said, well, what are we going to say? We can't change the name. We'll lose the few fans that we've got. I mean, we're not going to win anymore because it'd be exactly the same show. And he says, don't worry, I've got an idea. He says, if he says he doesn't like the name TV Burp, you've got to change it. What I'll say is, how about Harry Hill's TV Burp? And I said, I thought it was already called that. And he goes, is it? I don't know. Anyway, so we go in, and this Simon Shapps, he says, so don't like the name. And I said, where's this come from? Have you done some sort of market research? He says, well, what it was, I said to my PA, do you watch that TV Burt? And she said, no, I don't like the name. And I said, oh, okay, so, And at this point, the manager chipped in, how about if we change the name to Harry Hill's TV Burt? And he goes, no. He says, I'll tell you what we'll do. He said, we'll do some market research. If it comes back that people don't like the name, you'll change it. If they do like the name, you can keep it. Right? Cut to, so I didn't hear anything. Cut to the Comedy Awards, sort of 6 months later or 3 months later, where I am picking up the award for the best something, entertainment show or something. And I'm seated next to Simon Shapps. I pick up the award, I go and sit back down next to him, He goes, oh, well done. I say, oh, by the way, what happened about the market research? He said, well, we did the market research and, yeah, no one likes the name. But, you know.
Doesn't matter at that point.
Doesn't matter now. That is what we're up against.
But that's like 5 series of that. That's crazy.
It feels like there's a lot where...
That market research costs money. You know, the money it costs to do that market research. God knows how much it costs, but, you know, it's... Yeah.
It feels like you see, like, from, like, comedians of mine and Nick's vintage as well, it felt like... I think I've said this before on here, but it always feels like often they're taking a live show or something that was very big in Edinburgh or something and has a real sort of its own identity. And then they sort of... It filters through something and ends up on TV and not being the thing that they wanted in the first place. And it just always feels like, but that's not... Or they want to get people that have seen Edinburgh in a very kind of idiosyncratic show that they've made themselves. And yeah, they go, yeah. I'll tell you what, would you like to be in a thing I've made? And it sort of completely takes away what's unique about those performers. And I always think it's such a shame. And that feels like it's something new or something that seems to have happened in the last sort of maybe 10 or 15 years. And it feels like... The comedy shows that I would have watched in the kind of late 80s and 90s felt that they were more idiosyncratic, and each one, what was nice about it was they were all different and had their own identities. And they're all funny, but they're completely different shows, you know what I mean? It's this, you can look at...
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's true that you can't just take a stage show and put it on TV, or you rarely can you do that. So what you have to do is find a way of doing your thing, in a way that you're not doing, because no one can keep up that sort of turnover of stand-up. You know, you do need to find a way of doing it, so whatever that might be. But there are some really good commissioners and channel controllers, actually. You know, there are some really good ones, and I've worked with some really good ones. But, you know, the whole thing has changed, because even when I started, the budgets were being cut. You know, there was no... the Channel 4 show, we used to rehearse for a week. And the guy who... the director of it, who had directed the 2 Ronnies, he was like an elderly, you know, old guy. He also produced Top of the Pops. He was sort of moaning about us only having a week's rehearsal, but then no one rehearses at all now.
So when you did, so you won the Perrier for Best Newcomer in 1992? And then...
Was it 92, yeah.
Yeah, so when, so what was that show like?
That wasn't an award prior to that. What happened was that I did, when I was a doctor... I used to do the medical school reviews, and which is where these sort of, you know, Christmas, yeah. And so my little friend, Matt, he became the head of the drama society, and he got control of the funds, the money, the checkbook.
Right.
And so basically I would write these shows. This is a different thing to the reviews. I would write these shows and he would write the checks out. We put these shows on. And then the last year at medical school, or after we all qualified, I wrote this show like a sort of stupid play. And we took it up to Edinburgh, right? And I'd never even been to Edinburgh, right? Never been to the festival. Mm. So the first time I went was with this terrible play. And we'd only done it once at the medical school, right? And we did it at the Theatre West End. Do you know that theatre? It's a church. You know that big church on Princes Street?
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah.
So it was a long, narrow. I know this is a very circuitous answer to your question. It was a long, narrow room, right? So it was like 3 deep in front of you, but but then it went, you know, that way.
Yeah, it was wide.
And because we didn't know what we were doing, and because we had this money from the, you know, Review Society, we got this guy up to with a spotlight, right? So we put the spotlight over there. But the problem was, on the first night, someone would walk down this end and the spotlight would follow them and it would blind the... it would blind the entire audience. And there was this segment of it, sort of 3 or 4 minutes, where the lights go out and you just hear the voices, right? You just hear the actors' voices talking about, because it was about an operation, and I don't know. Anyways, the lights go out, the first night, the lights go out and we hear seats being, you know, shuffled about and doors. And when the lights come back up, it's like half the people. Right? But what I'm getting to is that I knew from that how to sort of knew the kind of ropes of how to promote a show, right? So the first 20-minute act I ever did, you know, the first 20 minutes I ever got paid for, I was on the bill with Alistair McGowan, who I'd never met before, in this place up in Clapham. And he goes, and we got on really well, and I said to him on that night, I said, we should go to Edinburgh together, right? So the first year I went up, I did as a stand-up, I did a two-hander with him. Sharing the hour, right? And the second year was with this show, Flies. There's the poster on the wall there. Oh, no, you can't see it because it's... I'm in my Sylvanian house. And what that was it's the usual thing. You've got like 40 minutes of material padded out with slides. And my mate Matt at that point had qualified. We were both qualified. I'd given up my job, but he was still working as a doctor. And he said, I'll only do it if you let me sing this song that he'd written about this girl that he fancied called Kath. Right? Right? And the song was... oh, Kath, I want to call out your name. I want you to feel the same way too. I want to fall in love with you. I mean, you know, I had no place in the in the show whatsoever, but I agree. And for the first, we only did a week, I think. I think we only did a week, or was it 2 weeks? Anyway, it opened. I had this trunk, which I would hide in. So the first week of it, for the sake of argument, or the first, you know, first amount of doing it, no one much came. So there'd be like, there'd probably be 10, 14 people, most of whom I would recognise because I handed them a leaflet. You know, Dutch people, you know, foreign tourists. And what would happen is when the time came, I'd get into the trunk on the stage, right? Matt would go and take the tickets. They would come in and sit down. He'd give me a, I don't know what the signal must have been, the music changing board, right? And then I would jump out of the box singing a song, right? And what happened was that William Cook from The Guardian, the kind of comedy, is that the first comedy correspondent. You know, there was no such thing as people just covering comedy. He sort of self-starred himself, this comedy correspondent. He wrote a review saying, okay, and the opening line of it was, I've seen the future of modern comedy and its name is Harry Hill, you know, like the Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
Like this fantastic review in The Guardian. Okay, so that day, fantastic. You know, we were like really thrilled. I get the review, I take the leaflets and I get the review printed up on the back of the leaflet. That night, I go to the venue, it's about 7:30, whatever it is, I get in the trunk, right? Normally, there'd be like 10, 12 people. I'd be in the trunk for a couple of minutes. That night, I'm in the trunk, and I'm in the trunk, and I'm in the trunk, and I'm hot and sweaty, right?
kind of thinking, what the hell's happened? Something's happened. You know, there's been a bomb scare or something.
And music goes up. I jump out of the box, right? And because I've been in it so long, I can't see. And once my eyes become sort of accustomed to the bright lights, I realise it's absolutely packed full of people. And then you know, there was this Perrier Award. It was like the Perrier Award thing. And they said to me, someone said to me, oh, you need to go to the Perrier Award. Really? Why? You know, because I wasn't nominated for the Perrier Award. I've forgotten who was there yet. Maybe it was Frank Skinner and Steve Coon. I don't know who it was. So I go along, and then they just announce it before the main award. They say it's going to be a special award, best newcomer, Harry Hill. Yeah, it was just fantastic. And the weird thing was that that night, the night of the Perrier Award, had been the last night of the show. So I got the award, and everyone's saying, who is this guy? Well, I want to see the show, and they couldn't.
Often, that still happens now. There's always, like, they announce the winner, and you've maybe got, like, two more shows left.
Yeah.
Like, why don't they do it earlier on? You just,
There was a lot to be said for it, because then it became a sort of, you know, like I was Zorro.
You can't see it.
But then the following year, of course, I went back and I did it was a better show, actually, because, you know, but I got a terrible time.
So at that point, so you weren't on the sort of comedy circuit at that point at all?
Yeah. No, I was, yeah.
Oh, you were, okay.
Yeah, I was out every night gigging. Yeah, I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
But did you...
So much work, back in those days, there was so much work, and it was all cash. it was just fantastic. I mean, tough to get into, but once you got on, you'd be, you know, two weekends would always be, you know, two gigs on a Friday, two or three. Cash.
How many comedians were there back then?
I don't know. There were loads.
But, like, it feels like there was...
You knew everyone. You did know everyone. Yeah. It's a different thing. I tell you, it was a lot different. I mean, I think the whole thing's changed since I started going to comedy. So when I was a student, I used to go and see comedy, and I used to follow people like Jack D, and I used to, like, you know, we've talked about this before, Jack D and Arthur Smith and Joe Brown, those old kind of guys. And in those days, the whole thing was so much more amateurish and shambolic. Every night, someone would die really, really badly. Like, you know, there'd be someone on that was, you know, there'd be a poet doing sort of heartfelt poetry, and there'd be a, you know, some terrible juggler, or, you know, it was a lot more varied. Right. And then it started to become a bit more, people got better at it. Or, you know, I don't know about you, but perhaps I haven't seen anyone really struggle or die for a long time.
Oh, yeah, I have.
You
That's
have.
Because...
Not you.
At Always Be Comedy, there's a mirror at the back of the room where you can see yourself on stage.
Do you think the audiences were more accepting then, though, or not at all? Do you think
they had lower expectations? They had lower expectations. Definitely.
That's what I wonder now. It feels almost that there is an expectation of going out, and you have to... there's almost a much... I don't know if I'm right in saying this, but almost like there is a sense of you are really on the bill with the best out there. So you do have to perform, and it feels like... Sometimes when I hear about people talking about gigs from... the sort of 90s era, you kind of get the impression that the people there were perhaps, they were more accepting of different types of comedy, whereas I sometimes wonder if audiences now, because they're so used to seeing a very slick version out on TV, that's what they expect to see. They expect to see a TV-level stand-up.
Yeah, I mean, even, I don't know, I mean, all the clubs are different. So, I mean, like, Jonglers was always tough and, you know, it was that audience. But, I mean, like, the Comedy Store, I always would get booked at the Comedy Store and usually had a really good time, you know. And I'm not an obvious Comedy Store act, you know. I don't know. It's easy to get sort of, you know, nostalgic about it. I don't know how many, in the answer to your question, I don't know how many comics there were around at that time, but you kind of knew everyone. You did know everyone, I think.
But so I first got into you to your Channel 4 series, and what I really thought was amazing about you transitioning over to ITV with TV Burke was that you didn't really, aside from the format, you didn't change your act in any way to go from Channel 4 series to being like one of the biggest comedians in the country. And I thought that that was always sort of something that was really sort of inspirational where you...
Well, I don't think you have any choice. I don't think you have any choice as a comedian. You know, this is what, when people say, you know, people are very opinionated, very, because it's very subjective. You know, they are very, they say, oh, that's, you know, I don't like him, he's not funny. Or why don't you do some, you know. I mean, believe me, there have been many, many times where I've thought, if only I had a couple of knob jokes to get me out of this.
Sure.
But I don't think you have any choice about the sort of humour you do. And I think that goes for, you know, it's not about necessarily being, me being what you might call absurdist or, you know, or surreal or whatever those words that people bandy about. You know, as someone who's like a straight down the line observational comic like Michael McIntyre, he doesn't have any choice about what he says. So, you know, you might not like it, you might not, or you might love it, but I don't think he's thinking, oh, you know, I'm gonna change my act to make it more, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But the thing that I adapt.
You have to adapt it, and I did adapt it significantly, actually, Nick.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
But the sensibility was the same. The sensibility was
similar. You're still recognisably Harry Hill from Channel 4 and Harry Hill on ITV, and it's kind of like but you got into a position where the audience found you. You went from like being a cult comedian.
Yeah, but that was
a huge comedian.
Yeah, well, what helped me with that was that it gave, because I was doing stuff about the week's TV, which is very familiar to ITV audiences, it gave them a way in.
Yeah. We've got to wrap up.
Right for that.
So we've got to play a game with you now, Harry, so I'm going to pass you over to Nathaniel.
A game show.
This is a game show. This is called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinion. So you have to predict what I would like. Beginning with Ben Fogle. Ben Fogle, is Benny Hill better or worse than Ben Fogle?
Better.
Better.
Better. Is Jonah Hill better or worse than Benny Hill?
Worse.
Probably is worse, all told. Joan Collins, better or worse than Jonah Hill?
Better. Worse.
Worse, I'd say.
I think worse. Yeah. Vinnie Jones, better or worse than Joan Collins?
Worse.
Catherine Zeta-Jones, better or worse than Vinnie Jones?
Better.
Worse.
Better. I think it's probably better. Tom Jones, better or worse than Catherine Zeta-Jones?
Better.
Tommy Lee Jones, better or worse than Tom Jones?
Worse.
Is he the guy from Men in Black?
That's the one.
Worse.
Jamie Lee Curtis, better or worse than Tommy Lee Jones?
Better.
It's very close to that, I think.
What do you think, Harry?
Better.
Maybe better, yeah. I don't know, yeah, better.
It is better, yeah. Christopher Lee.
Tony Curtis, isn't she?
Yes. Christopher Lee, better or worse than Jamie Lee Curtis?
Better.
Better.
Well, yeah, I met Christopher Lee.
Once. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Spike Lee, better or worse than Christopher Lee?
Worse.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, he is worse.
I'll get you in trouble.
Yeah, worse.
I got 10 out of 10. I got 10 out of 10. I absolutely
smashed that. Was that 9?
You got 9 out of 10, Harry. So you are up there with Luke Morley. You're better than Susie Dent. And you're also better than Henry Normal and Johnny Vegas with 7. Thank you for coming on, Harry Hill. It's been lovely to talk to you. See you next week, guys. Thanks for listening. Stay safe.